So, let's see. We are going to be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 through 9 today. The entire chapter of 1 Corinthians 7 is actually a single unit that I think it's going to end up being divided into three parts for the purposes of discussion. So we'll skip the first page here because we've already talked about it. So on the second page, we'll see the kind of the basic outline for the chapter, this chapter 7. There are 40 verses here. First, and it's going to be divided into, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Nine subtopics within here. And we're going to be taking the first two today. Equality and conjugal rights, and widows and widowers. So as was just read before we began, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 through 5, verse 1 begins, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal right, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." This is a quote from New International Commentary, the first epistle by Gordon Fee. And in his view, the controlling motif of Paul's answer in the entirety of chapter 7 is, "Do not seek a change in status."
If you're single, stay single.
It says, but it says, if you cannot control your sexual desires, do marry so you do not burn with sexual
So how are we to understand what Paul is saying? How do we read the very first verse of this chapter, where he writes, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman"? Now,
I don't have my Bible with me. Was that a question or was that a statement?
It's a statement. "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman."
Okay, that's why I didn't catch it. It is good, not is it good.
Yeah, it is good. So, first off, translations are divided into how the translators have chosen to interpret this verse. Now remember, all translation is interpretation. Most older translations, but a few new ones as well, translate this verse 1 as Paul affirming celibacy as the preferred condition. In other words, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman is interpreted to be Paul's statement.
And see, I would have gone the other way. He says, "I'm going to talk about what you assumed, and he assumed."
Yeah, the way we've been reading Paul's stuff, he starts with something they said.
Most newer translations take the position that Paul is quoting the Corinthian letter, a line from the Corinthian letter. in the medieval, yeah. So the older translations, including most of the medieval period understanding, was that Paul was stating his position. And so we are going to prefer the latter, modern interpretation.
We? You didn't take a vote.
I am going to. Yeah. The context in which Paul is responding to this Corinthian letter is that this powerful group, the arrogant group, that seems to have control over the Corinthian church, is that they are advocating celibacy, singleness, and asceticism.
What is asceticism?
They're close to synonyms, so just kind of put them over.
Yeah, they're synonyms.
Okay.
It's depriving yourself of worldly pleasure.
Asexuality.
Yeah. So refraining from sex would be a part of asceticism. Indulging in pleasurable food and drink and entertainment would also be included in that.
Refraining from nothing
pleasant
allowed.
So self-denial.
And asceticism is sometimes taken to a point of actually starving yourself.
There's no answer to this question, but it just seems odd to me that we would preserve Corinthians for all these centuries. Why don't we have any reference to what he's responding to? It just was lost.
It was lost.
It just seems odd that someone would have kept it around.
So that is a likely context in which Paul is responding. And so
a lot more sense.
Within the church, there were already people who were married, and now this group is saying you need to be single, you need to be celibate. There's pressure on the married to dissolve marriage and or to remain celibate. Because it's more spiritual. And they might be saying that if you're married and you can't remain celibate, then divorce. Because it's better to be divorced and to be spiritual than to be married. And obviously, there's pressure on singles to remain single. Now, one evidence that can be given to Paul, if Paul had wanted to affirm celibacy as his preferred position, why was he so careful in his use of the term body versus spirit back in chapter 6, verses 16 through 17, where Paul wrote that if a person has sexual relations with a prostitute, that person becomes one body with the prostitute. On the other hand, in the parallel verse, in the next verse, Paul writes that a person, when he is joined to Christ, becomes one spirit, not one body. He could have written one body and discouraged marriage, but he didn't. Paul certainly was not an ascetic. Paul affirmed Jewish norms. One of the Jewish norms was it is not good to be single. Throughout his letters, he affirms Jewish positions.
He affirms the Jewish norms and cultural standards everywhere he goes.
So Paul affirms the social norm of marriage in verse 2.
So what was it, the Christians that were wanting this more spiritual level?
There was a group within the Corinthian believers, within the Corinthian church, that was a very vocal group, influential group, that was possibly promoting an ascetic form of living as more spiritual.
You know, that is so not what God wanted us to do.
That's so true, though.
He wanted us to be happy and enjoy pleasurable things.
Uh-huh. If everyone was single, though, then the human race would cease to exist.
In a very short time.
A lot of churches died for that very reason.
Yeah.
So, Paul writes, but because of the temptation, but that phrase, the temptation, is not present in the Greek. So literally it reads, but because of the sexual immoralities, plural, each man should have relations with his own wife, and each woman relations with her own husband. It's definitely taught, Paul is definitely writing about sex here. There's no question about it.
Talking about same sex.
This is often read as a concession.
Right.
That because of the temptation to sexual immorality, you should be married.
Right, that's what's always been done.
Because you're going to do it anyway.
But as Gordon Fee in his commentary notes, this text is not anticipating future temptations, but addressing the reality that some of the married couples have been depriving one another of sexual relations, causing one or the other to go to prostitutes.
So this is reflecting back towards this. Don't.
Because you have been tempting each other by depriving each other.
Not only just tempting, but they have actually been going to prostitutes. Paul is saying that it's wrong. The norm is for married people to have sexual relations with one another.
And he's kind of saying that to not do that is itself immoral.
Yeah.
In verse 5, where it reads, "Do not deprive one another," the word "deprive" can also be translated "defraud."
Oh my!
Do not defraud, and we encountered that word already earlier in this essay, where Paul accused the Corinthian believers of defrauding one another in their actions and attitudes.
So, when a couple are having a closeness, and if all of a sudden they're like apart, you're really apart. And it becomes apparent, you know, that you live separate lives.
So Paul is saying, don't defraud, don't deprive one another of what you are, your responsibilities to one another. Because by doing so, you are acting as agents of Satan, basically.
You are the one that is the problem.
Paul's position is asceticism is not good. You are helping break apart the body. Remember, when two people have sexual relations, the theological position is that you are no longer two but one. By depriving one another, by defrauding one another, you are breaking that oneness.
You're breaking apart the body of Christ, basically.
Yeah. In verse 3, Paul addresses both the husband and the wife. Both are equal partners.
Yeah, you hear the husband has a right to his wife, but you never hear.
And notice that Paul writes give, not demand. Nowhere in this essay does Paul allow either partner to demand his or her rights from the other. It has to be a voluntary giving on both parts. What Paul is getting at is love cannot be demanded or coerced. Otherwise, it's not love.
Right. When you hear about conjugal rights, you don't ever hear about it that way. You always hear it being given to the man, and it is the right hand to the man in jail. Well,
and he's demanding his right from the state.
Well, and she won't give it to him. You never hear about a woman having that right from her husband. And you always hear about it being demanded. Huh.
Paul is writing this set of verses to the one who is withholding sex for whatever reason. In this case, it's probably asceticism. In the first part of verse 5, Paul offers a concession. Except, perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer. It's a concession. It's not an ideal. It's not a command from Paul that you have to do this. But it's a concession that, okay, so you might feel like you're more spiritual if you go through this period of abstention. Okay, so Paul concedes that it's allowed, but only for a temporary period.
To me, that seems like it's kind of
awesome. Well, but he's saying you just accept perhaps by agreement for a limited time. There's like lots of little...
He's very reluctant, but he's saying, okay, so I will grant that, you know, there's this pressure to do so.
Yeah, but if they had stayed to accept by agreement for a limited time for... leave it blank or for medical reasons, but to say prayer in there, I think to me this kills the whole thing.
Because they didn't know about medical reasons back then. He was using it as an example.
But he has so many if except perhaps by...
You're paralyzed now, your neck is broken, well, but... Gosh, darn it.
Paul is not addressing the broader issue. He's addressing the specific issue of asceticism as more spiritual.
But asceticism would jump on that prayer too often, and he gave him a way out.
Okay, so
The important thing is mutual agreement is necessary. See, sex is a right and gift of each partner from the other. Both must agree to return the gift to the other for a period of time.
Well, he's conceding the concept of fasting. And, I mean, yeah, people do fast in various ways, and he's saying, yeah, you can do that. And that makes sense.
As long as you recognize that it is a fast which requires afterwards a breakfast.
Right. As opposed to a continual lifestyle.
Right.
So there's always a tendency within religious circles to elevate spiritual disciplines as above everyday living. Uh-huh. Paul is saying no. Spiritual disciplines are not more important. They are valuable, but they are not more important than everyday living, like being married. He's also saying to the ascetics who say that spiritual disciplines are more important, spiritual disciplines can be practiced fully by married people. Singleness and celibacy are not required in order to practice spiritual disciplines. And in verse 4, Paul again affirms the equality and mutuality in marriage. Neither partner can demand sex from the other. Neither partner is allowed to deprive sex from the other. Each partner must freely give to the other and willingly receive from the other. Each partner can say to the other, I give gifts and I have rights and I have authority over your body. Both partners, each partner. Paul's attitude is revolutionary in a society where women were often just property. Or if they had any rights, their rights were far less than that of men. So it's easy to see how this aspect of Paul's preaching would attract women of high standing in Greco-Roman society. We see a couple examples of that in given in Acts chapter 17, verses 4 and 12. Finally, in the Corinthian church, the bizarre reasoning that sex is evil or sin within marriage, but sex with prostitutes is fine.
That's right, we talked about that last week.
Paul tells them they've got things reversed. So this is from the Bible Background Commentary. Some philosophers rejected marriage, but thought that sexual release with prostitutes was acceptable, since it would not tie a person down.
I see.
So it appears that the Corinthian believers, at least some of them, had incorporated that line of reasoning. That sex within marriage was evil, but sex with prostitutes was just fine because it wasn't part of marriage. It makes no sense to us, but it made perfect sense to them.
No, it doesn't make any sense. I can't say what they thought of it.
Or they could have just been very defiant themselves. You know, egotistical or something,
Men going to prostitutes was a commonly accepted practice within the Greek and Roman society.
That was for many centuries after that, too.
Yeah.
It wasn't considered evil. And we discussed last week that it was even Augustine. Augustine, one of the church fathers, conceded that it was necessary in order to for the marriage to remain.
Did some religions practice it as a religious?
Yeah. There was, but the reasoning was that if married men could freely go to prostitutes, they wouldn't feel the pressure to commit adultery with other married people.
As in, you have that release available, you're
friend's somebody else's wife, so it's okay.
We live in a culture where everybody's an equal human being, but back then, they weren't equal human beings.
No.
Prostitutes weren't.
And as you kept explaining, marriage was more of a thing to guarantee hereditary lines and relationships between countries and peoples and whatever. And so,
which is why a man marrying his late father's wife was considered horrendously horrific, where a man going to a prostitute wasn't a big deal.
But what we have to remember is that's so stupid to us. But we are as blind and stupid to things within our culture that we cannot see either. Just don't know where they are. But I'm sure you'll tell me. Where am I supposed to be?
So, next four verses here. Chapter 7, verses 6 through 9. Now, as a concession, not a command, I say this, I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another.
Yeah, what is he talking about there?
To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion.
I think you would have been better if you left 7 and 8 out.
The majority of translations that have subject or paragraph divisions in commentaries place verses 6 and 7 into the previous discussion. In other words, the this of I say this refers to Paul's concession that abstention from sex is permitted for a period of prayer, or that the concession is to the married condition itself, given Paul's preference for singleness. Now, Ken Bailey, as well as reading the New Testament commentaries, place these verses with verses 8 and 9. And when that happens, we have an AB-AB structure where Paul states a wish, his personal wish, and then he talks about gifts. Talks about wish, and then he talks about gifts. And so I say this of verse 6 looks forward rather than backward. This referring to, I wish that all were as I myself am. In other words, Paul is conceding that his personal preference, again, not to be taken as an ideal state or a command. His personal preference for celibacy does agree in part with the ascetic's assertion that abstention from sex can have positive effects. So that's his concession. His concession is to the group that is advocating asceticism.
I can see how you could say he prefers it personally, but why would he say he wishes somebody else did? Maybe because it's working out so well.
Well, what happens is the eschatological view that he has is that time is very, 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 very short.
Right.
And that there are going to be troubles coming.
Well, he's not alone in that feeling. That's very prevalent in all times.
He's going to talk about that down in verses 25 through 31.
And so there are more important things to spend your time and energy on than that.
He would have been prudent to be silent. He would have saved a lot of problems over the centuries.
But then he writes, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. What is he talking about here? He's talking about celibacy as a spiritual gift.
Huh.
It is a spiritual gift. That is the one of one kind. Paul happens to have that gift. Uh-huh. One of another refers to marriage as the other spiritual gift. Neither is better than the other.
Yeah.
Both are equally good. They're just different. So singleness or celibacy is not an ideal state nor a higher spiritual condition than marriage. On the other hand, marriage is not an ideal state either, though it's a normal state for most. Nor is marriage better spiritually than celibacy or singleness.
So you can be either one, just who you are, be it.
Yeah.
Be who you are?
Be who you are.
Okay. Well, that
be who you are gifted to be. Don't condemn, if you're married, don't condemn singles for not being married. Or if you're married, don't envy singleness for some married people. Each should accept whichever gift he or she has been given and don't seek a change.
So that doesn't mean if you're single, don't seek to get married. It means if singleness is...
If you're happy with being single,
ideal state.
Don't get married for the sake of getting married because the church says it's better to be married. Then he goes to the unmarried and widows. The word unmarried is from the Greek agamos, which is best read as widowers. He's not talking about those who have never been married. He's talking about those who have been married. The ancient languages didn't really have a word for widower. Had words for widows, because that was a common problem. I guess the commentary says that the ancient Greek had a word for widower, but it had fallen out of use. And so Paul kind of makes up a word.
That's an interesting concept, that a widower didn't exist in their culture. basically.
It wasn't a concept.
It was, it wasn't a state that needed to be addressed.
I think the widower, because he was the provider or whatever, he could do something about his state.
Yeah.
The widows, they could do something.
A man whose wife has died,
he was in control of his
wife. He doesn't need providing for. He doesn't have to, I don't have a wife, I can't.
So in essence, in their culture, a widower didn't stay a widower very long. And probably didn't exist in concept.
Probably.
Huh.
Hmm. Paul again is addressing both men and women equally who had been married. And Paul is likely to have been a widower. What Paul is saying is they shouldn't seek remarriage as a better state. In this passage, Paul is clearly stating his opinions. Whereas in the case of conjugal rights, he was working from theology, Old Testament theology. In verses 6 through 9, he's working off of his opinions based on experience and what he thinks is best. So, based on perspectives on eschatology and personal experience. So Paul is saying, I wish everyone was single like me could be likened to me saying, I wish everyone liked sushi like I do. It's stating a preference based on personal experience and benefits of the preference.
Oh my.
But far from a command or law.
I like being me, in other words. Mm-hmm.
That's good.
That does...
So if a person doesn't have the gift of celibacy, then that's verse 9. Verse 9. If a person doesn't have the gift of celibacy, then it is better to be remarried than to deny the gift of marriage and try to act in ways God did not gift you.
Oh my. Okay. Well, that actually kind of makes sense. Huh.
In this discussion, Paul is not discussing right versus wrong. He's discussing what is good and what is better based upon each unique circumstance. And finally, the word where it says to burn with passion is added by translators. It's considered by most to be the best interpretation. The other alternative it would be to burn in judgment. So
how much was added? The whole sentence?
No.
With passion.
With passion.
Oh, with passion.
For it is better to marry than to burn.
Mine says with sexual desire.
If that's what was added, it's those last three. Okay.
Someone else might say to burn in hell.
So burn is in there.
For your sexual desire.
Yeah. So when you're hot is an old, old concept.
You're going to be hot somewhere.
So, once again, Gordon Fee in his commentary writes, in regards to this passage, in this case, then Paul is not so much offering marriage as the remedy for sexual desire for inflamed youth, which is the most common way of viewing the text, but as the proper alternative for those who are already consumed by that desire and are sinning. Because remember, the context so far is that those... the ascetics are saying it's better to be single, it's better to remain celibate. But some people don't have that gift. But they can't marry because to marry them would enter a less spiritual state. So what do you do? Well, according to Greek and Roman thought, going to prostitutes is just fine. And Paul is trying to stop all of this nonsense. Context is very important. So some final thoughts here. Because these are only the first 9 verses out of this entire chapter, which contains 40 verses. We shouldn't be drawing too many firm conclusions yet. But what we can say from what we've seen is that asceticism as a permanent lifestyle, Paul is clearly saying it is evil. Because asceticism denies the goodness of the body. In Hebrew thought, the body is good. In Roman and Greek thought, the body was often evil. Hebrew thought, but the body is good.
And in Roman and Greek thought, if the spirit is good and the body is evil, then you can just let the body do whatever it feels like, and it doesn't matter, and you rely on the spirit to be the good part.
Asceticism also breaks relationships. Obviously, in this immediate case between married people, but the fact that the emphasis on asceticism was being promoted by a certain group, it was breaking the church body also. And contrary to what it appears, asceticism is ultimately self-centered. It's about what can I do to make myself better so that I can lord it over others who aren't quite as good.
That's the ultimate conclusion of
that. Breaking the body.
And in the second piece that we looked at, we can conclude that neither singleness or marriage is better or worse. They're simply different. Each person is suited to one or the other. It's a charisma, a spiritual gift. Some churches and sects have misread Paul and prioritized singleness and celibacy as, quotes, more spiritual. Paul, I believe, would be in vehement disagreement with this line of thinking. On the other hand, many churches elevate and idealize and even idolize the married condition. In these communities, singleness is viewed as a curse. Why aren't you married yet? How many times have Christians asked that of other Christians? Marriage is seen as a metaphor or model of the church and the relationship of Christians with Christ. But is that proper? Perhaps the church in Christ can be seen as a model of marriage, but we shouldn't be going the other way around.
Well, my mom used to say, it's better to be an old maid than wish you were.
In communities where marriage is idealized, the full blessings of Christian life are thought to be reserved for the marrieds. You can't fully experience all that you're meant to unless you're married. Because
so it's basically saying be who you are.
Yeah,
you know how that works.
Paul would be in vehement disagreement with that kind of reasoning as well. The one that prioritizes marriage over singleness. So going back to the guiding principle throughout this entire chapter, don't seek a change in status unless it is truly required and justified. Or don't envy a different status.
And don't lord it on people, give them a guilt complex.
For sure, yeah. Huh. All right.
Those are the first 9 verses of chapter 7. We still have quite a bit to go. That's where we're going to stop today.
All right.